speak up, up. Speak, speak up, speak, speak up, up, up. Speak, speak up, up. Speak up, speak, speak up. Up. Speak, speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, May the 12th, 2025. Joining me in studio today,
Peter R.H.
and Stephen Fan.
And I am Magnus Thiebold. We're happy to be here with you and glad you are out there at home listening to us. Wouldn't be much point for us to be here if you weren't there yourself. So thank you for that. We got some interesting stories. We got a story from Jesse Wentzloff about Red Dress Day at SFU. We also have a story about the value of balcony gardening for pollinators. As you may know, well, pollination is really important to the whole plant ecosystem, particularly in urban areas where there's a lot less foliage. What are you going to talk about today, Peter?
Mark Carney was involved. It starts with a B. What's that company was involved with? Brookfield or something?
Investment banking firm.
No, but it was Brookfield, I think.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Ezra Levant went to Bermuda to check out the office that was supposedly there for it. Mm-hmm. And the Iowa, what's on the video is him going there. He said it was too expensive to stay overnight, so he got a two-way thing for the same day. But it was sort of interesting that he was, it was above a bicycle top. It was sort of a bit of an office. It was sort of interesting. He went to the Iowa Man earlier for one of their little offices that supposedly wasn't there either. But I'm also going to be a bit critical of something else with Revel News. But it was sort of interesting. Canada Land did something that was they didn't go to Bermuda or anything, but they did a little – I think it was broadcast on the stage because we get Canada Land. But they yep. – it's a bit convoluted about he has options of shares or whatever. But anyway, so I'll be talking a bit about that. And I'll be critical – don't worry. I got something critical about Ezra Levant for everybody.
All right.
Coming up.
Okay. Hey, Stephen.
Oh, yeah, good morning. But, like, I think, you know, obviously the big news over the weekend is the decrease in tariffs between the United States and China that was announced, I think, midnight Western West Coast time last night. And they're now going from 145% on the U.S. side to 30% on China, and then from 125% on the Chinese side down to 10%, so 115% decrease on each side.
Although you got to keep in mind that that doesn't even take it back to where it was before Trump started this war. This is like Trump creating a problem and then going, look, I undid the problem.
I think China actually had the power to get it down to 10% if they wanted to. I don't think they necessarily want to, because a world in which there's 10% on everyone else and 30% on China, it's better for China than 10% on China and 0% on everyone else.
Right.
Because it just means that, you know, the United States is getting really kind of secluded from the global supply chains, and to some extent...
Well, it's not good strategy to start a trade war with everybody all at once, any more than it's a good strategy to start a war with all of your neighbors all at once.
I think there's the issue of essentially... There are various national security hawks in the U.S. administration who consider this a golden opportunity to, quote-unquote, counter China. But the reality is that Trump just likes tariffs. There's no grand strategic calculus. He just really loves tariffs. He's the tariff man. So I don't know.
I think one thing we've seen is that pretty much all this policy is just whatever it is Trump thinks.
It's like the Alcatraz thing. You know, he sees a movie and he wants to reopen Alcatraz.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And so that's sort of the world we live in now, whatever Trump's whims are. I mean, most of these policies go against everything that has been, I wouldn't even say it's Republican directions, you know, the whole sort of consensus of, you know, leaderships around the world around reducing tariffs and stuff, you know.
I think the United States has been, for the most part, a true beneficiary in the increasing mm-hmm. global trade and reduction in tariffs. And, you know, to some extent, people have talked about the sweatshop conditions that exist in third world countries. But for the most part, I'm not saying every single instance, for the most part, the United States has benefited.
Right.
Obviously, there are cases like auto plants shutting down in Youngstown, Ohio, or whatever. But also, you kind of have to admit that even before this happened, there were jokes about how you wouldn't want to buy a car made in the Midwest that's made on a Monday in the hunting season, because people would be like still like 3 years, like three beers in, completely buzzed from like the weekend shooting. So that was the world like the United States inhabited in the 1970s, and it's kind of hard to picture that now. I think the real question, I think, is what's going to happen with the U.S.-China relationship, because it's clearly very discretionary. It's very kind of it's kind of up in the air. But I think it would be really interesting, and this is something people have talked about a lot, people who are professionals, is the potential for U.S. and China to do a deal around where the U.S. will relax tariffs and China will invest in the United States with stuff like BYD plants and, you know, like battery plants and solar plants and stuff like that. And that would actually be very mutually beneficial. So we'll see.
Well, there's something that I just saw on my tablet, a YouTube posting. He supposedly, I don't know if this is as new as today, but he wants to take prescription drugs down up to like 80% and so on. But what on the posting that I saw, what the person was saying, that this could be struck down quite easily in the Senate or the House.
It's strictly ultra vires. It's outside his constitutional powers. But I don't.
Also, what tools is he going to use to do that?
But like, I think
can't just do an edict and tell companies where to set their prices.
But
right?
here's my kind of take on this. I'm not too worried about the legal side. I don't think he's going to get anything done on the legal side. I think the thing that's intriguing to me is that prescription drug prices are too high in the United States, as it is anywhere else, but they exist in an ecosystem whereby the United States pharmaceutical market is literally 50% of the worldwide pharmaceutical market by dollar value.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that every dollar that the United States gets taken out of its pharmaceutical market in an attempt to reach price parity with other countries where it's cheaper, like Canada or Netherlands or whatever, is ultimately just a $1 less going into the market. And there is some waste, there's some corruption in the market, in the sense that a lot of the fundamental research are funded by the National Institutes of Health, and pharmaceutical companies are not necessarily necessary to the operation. But ultimately, it's the drug discoveries we have are because there's an economic model there. The United States trying, and this is also why, so Bernie Sanders trying to re-import drugs from Canada, that was never going to work. Canada's not going to allow it, but also the economics is going to just blow up on its face.
Well, if I could just add, what they said in the posting was, one of the things they were saying was a bit, he was disingenuous, Trump, with it, was because he's not going to cooperate with Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. Suppose Bernie Sanders said, well, cooperate with us and we'll get it through. So they were saying he's just doing a virtual signal. Well, I tried and I'm so concerned. I mean,
and I suspect that's more the case. You know, I think this is just a good news distraction from the fact that even with the change in, you know, tariffs to China, you know, the big drop in trade volume, even for a month, and the disruption to supply chains and stuff, it's going to come up with a big negative impact. I mean, we're looking, you might remember when that ship got stuck in the Suez Canal and blocked passage through there, and it created all these knock-on effects through the world economy by blocking this major trade route for whatever it was, a week and a half or something like that. You know, already, you know, West Coast ports are seeing huge drop-offs in the flow of goods from China, and that might start coming
back.
But that's going to take a month or more to play out, not to mention the fact that you know, a lot of companies rush bought stuff before the tariffs went in. So now they got stock, but they're not going to buy stuff.
There's going to be
a lot of companies
buying.
Stopped. You know, they didn't order stuff because they didn't know how much it was going to cost, or they knew it was uneconomic, not knowing when how long these tariffs would last and whether they're going to go back up again. So we're about to see the impact of that, you know, in the economy. And it's important to remember a lot of that impacts the consumer side of the economy, and the consumer economy is what really drives the American economy.
Absolutely. It's a consumer-driven economy, and it's driven by consumer finance, housing finance. And I think if you look at what's happening with the trade, for example, there's a prediction, well, there's expectation, really, that there will be a massive surge in inventories right now because of the lower tariffs. People are trying to get in front of Christmas. People don't know what's going to happen with the tariffs in 3 months or 4 months or 5 months. So they're desperately trying to get whatever they can get their hands on from China in time for Christmas. That's the big rush. So there's going to be a huge boom in orders, if any, which is ironic. But I think, you know, like, yeah, like it's rough. And I think the overall economy, it just has all these external disruptions. But, you know, like I would say, obviously Trump is never going to do this. But if you want to improve healthcare costs, pharmaceutical costs in the United States, what the government should be doing is more directly funding research, bypassing, you know, all like the billion-dollar marketing budgets of the big pharmaceutical companies. That's what should be happening. But taking money out of the market at the final dollar level, that is not going to work, because at the end of the day, if you look at a lot of the drugs that are developed, that's even $2-3 billion blockbuster drugs, or through $200 million drugs, there's not a huge amount of margin there. You really need to be able to get a sense of how big the market is. And I mean, the United States has the bulk to unilaterally negotiate drug prices if it wants to. The reality is that there's going to be less pharmaceutical research down the road.
All right, so Mark Carney visited the White House last week.
He seems to have done well. Yeah.
It appears that, and this seems to matter in terms of foreign policy interactions with Trump, that he likes Mark Carney.
I think he respects pretty obvious, Mark Carney.
It was pretty obvious he really, really, really did not like Justin Trudeau.
He really didn't like Chrystia Freeland. And I think there's a very specific reason for that, because Trump is kind of a little bit shy to say the real reason, is that Chrystia Freeland has been doing a lot of, what's the right word? Vigilante work on Ukraine. And Trump,
I don't know if I'd use that term, but...
It's outside the system is what that meant. It's kind of outside the formal system. And it's been there are reports coming out of Ottawa that Chrystia Freeland has been sort of under the table, being liaising with elements of quote-unquote resistance left in the United States in order to outbid Trump, specifically on the Ukraine question, on the Ukraine issue. And that has been a great irritation, obviously, for the administration, because if that, there's one thing the administration is united on, you know, they're not united on anything, but if there is one thing they're united on, is that they want to retrench a little bit on Ukraine. And this has been a thorn on their side. So Trump will always talk about how, you know, Chrystia, she wasn't so nice in sort of USMCA, USMCA negotiations in his first term, but honestly, he never displayed any indication that he cared about this until 1 or 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he didn't like Trudeau because Trudeau mocked him at some point, you know, at international conferences. And that's just something you can't take back. That's unfortunate. And I don't think Justin Trudeau should have actually done that, because it was undiplomatic. But Chrystia Freeland, again, locked in, it was kind of a tough situation. I think she's probably going to remain in the cabinet tomorrow, because the new cabinet is going to be announced tomorrow. It's going to be a cabinet again with gender parity, which is great. But I think Trump has very specific reasons for disliking Freeland, and I think Mark Carney would be wise not to fight him on this, if to the extent that's possible and consistent with.
Well, I mean, already there's different ministers leading the trade portfolios.
I mean, she is definitely not going to be allowed to handle trade. She's handling transport. She's basically being stuck in a file drawer somewhere in like a corner.
Well,
of
we'll see where that comes, because of course that was you know, a move Trudeau made. So we'll see where that goes tomorrow. She's obviously one of their high profile people, but probably won't be put on the Trump front.
It's unlikely. But it's also, I think Mark Carney also wants to leave his own footprint on the key issues, and the key issues does involve Trump and trade.
Well, if I could just, even before he got elected, right when he got became prime minister, he went to Europe to get some sort of
support.
Yeah. And he was kind of criticized, but I think he did exactly the right thing. That's what he initially did. Now, I think the meeting with Donald Trump is kind of a lot of white noise in a sense, because
I agree.
Because the point is that he's establishing the ties globally. Mm-hmm. That's the more important thing. So what he did was he firmly said, look, I don't want us to join the United States. He firmly said that. And that was important to say. But a lot of, like, you can read a lot of whatever into it. But I think he did well, and he just firmly said that. And really, the thing is not so much dealing with Donald Trump as dealing with the whole rest of the world is basically how I think we're going to come through it, our country.
All right. Well, thanks for that, guys.
Pleasure.
We will be. Well, you guys will be back. Well, you'll be back next week, yeah?
I hope so.
Okay.
It's a holiday next week.
Probably the week after.
We're going to have to pre-record, and Magnus always wants to pretend it's live when it's a free recording.
Don't give up our secrets, Peter.
There's no secret. Okay. My goodness, my God.
Next up here, we have a report from Jesse Wensloff, our local journalism initiative reporter here at CJSF Radio, about Red Dress Day here at SFU.
The red dress, hanging from a window, a porch, or a doorway, is a powerful symbol and a reminder of the ongoing epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. Monday, May 5th, was Red Dress Day, and the National Day of Awareness and Remembrance for the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and 2SLGBTQI+ people. And red dresses hang throughout all three campuses of Simon Fraser University. At the entrance of the Burnaby campus's Student Union Building, a memorial display has been set up by SFU's Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, or SVSPO, and the Women's Center, giving students, staff, and community members the opportunity to remember, memorialize, and pay tribute. Konstantin Lazitsky, a staff member at Out on Campus, SFU's 2SLGBTQI+ student organization, attended the memorial.
I think it's a very powerful symbol of the red dress because it is so striking and so visual, and then it reminds you just seeing one or two, and then you start seeing more and more of them around campus, seeing them on different campuses, seeing them in the community, just to give you a tangible way to realize the scope of what is happening and how it isn't just, oh, somebody else's cousin or sibling is lost, or somebody else in the community that I'm not really connected to. All of those stories are real, but they may not connect to you on the same way as it is hundreds and thousands of people that should be here, that should be in community, that should be still doing everything they wish to do, but instead they're not here with us. And so I think it is a way to bring some sort of symbol of them back, to bring something that was taken away, that is no longer here, to bring the people who are important back into the communities where they matter. And so I think it is so important to see visible and proud declarations that this is a day to remember all of the folks that were taken and they're gone, and that we're hoping will one day be returned to their communities.
Paula Quilos-Cruz is an educator with the SVSPO and helped organize the memorial.
Today we are hosting awareness tables and memorials in the three different SFU campuses in Vancouver, Burnaby, and Surrey. We wanted to make sure that non-Indigenous people have a space where they can come and honor missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit folks, learn more about it, what actions they can take, to reflect also on their own commitment and how we can change this epidemic as well. And then to have a space to meet with other people and maybe do some coloring pages and some pins. Also bring offerings to the memorial table, or they can take one of the flowers that we have there and they can bring it back to the land or a park close to their home. Thinking about all those sisters and friends and grandmas and aunties and the daughter of someone and some other folks who are no longer here because of this colonial epidemic that is happening in Canada. The Red Dress started as a campaign many years ago that was entitled the Red Dress Project, and it was launched in 2014 by Métis artist Jamie Black. And what this artist wanted to do was to honoring all these women who are no longer here with one red dress. And so that is the symbolism of the red dress, the ones that are not here, but that again are present, and it should be in all our memories to remember that is not something that we need to forget.
Kilos Clues started by connecting with Indigenous-led organizations on campus.
It was very important first to consult with the staff from Indigenous Student Center, as we wanted to, of course, honor the Indigenous voices and how we could do this in a respectful way.
This consultation helped ensure the event was culturally appropriate, and the collaboration led to a display that is engaging and interactive.
I thought that having a memorial table is really important, just to pace yourself and stand in front of this table and reflect what is happening here, and also make the table interactive. So that's why we invite people to bring offerings like a leaf or a stone or anything that they wanted to bring to the table. But if they couldn't, then they will have the possibility to take something from the table and connect with the land, because we know that Indigenous folks are connected with the land, and then the land is also part of their lives. So as a way to kind of honoring both things.
Julia Lane is one of the many people who stopped by the memorial.
I am here because I think it's incredibly important on this day, but also all days, for us to remember and hold very close in our hearts the kin who we have in the larger human context of being related to one another, who have been stolen from us, whether that is being murdered or by being stolen and they are now what we would call missing Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit folks, and recognizing that that is a really horrifying, tragic, and violent part of ongoing colonization in these lands. I'm feeling... I came in feeling overwhelmed, so I'm feeling overwhelmed, but I'm also feeling really grateful to the folks who put it together and put it on as a place for us to hold those feelings of sadness and overwhelm together. And I'm feeling very grateful for the invitation that I was offered to take a rose and to bring the rose to the land, because it feels like an active thing that I can do and an opportunity to remember the women and the girls and the Two-Spirit people, and also hold beauty and remember that there is beauty in addition to all of the harm and the hurt and the sadness.
One of the activities at the memorial prompted visitors to take a piece of paper shaped like a dress and write down actions to help raise awareness and work towards ending the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. As Lane explains, it can be a daunting challenge.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough to think about what kinds of actions are helpful, because I feel like so often actions that we hear about or think about or talk about are just not enough, and I feel that. So yeah, I guess one of the things that I've been reflecting on recently is just like recognizing and naming the all the like really deeply insidious ways that violence is interconnected. Violence against so many folks, violence against women, and violence against the land. And so recognizing these intersections and these interconnections and naming them and calling them out and being really consistent about that so that we are able to challenge the more like insidious forms of this kinds of toxicity and violence when it comes up might be a way that we help to keep it from escalating into the really extreme forms of violence that also continue to happen.
Regardless of what suggestions might be made, Kilos Clues hopes that students and community members can take something hopeful and useful away from the memorial.
So just to reflect and learn more about the history of Canada, because there could be some students that maybe are just arriving, they don't know what happened before. So learn more about the history. They can hang a red dress in their window, or they can wear all this week red if they want. Also reading the final report from the National Inquiry of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls and see how they can work in one of those actions, and also as individuals, an invitation to reflect what as change makers, because we are all change makers in this community, they can do in order to bring more awareness or share this with family or talk with their partner, with their friend, and support different Indigenous initiatives here on campus and also outside of campus, challenge lots of biases and stereotypes towards Indigenous people. So there are so many ways that folks can create action towards this. It could be something small, something big, but at the end of the day, if we are actioning something, then we're making a difference.
For CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, on the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam and Squamish-speaking peoples, I'm Jesse Wentzloff. This report is made possible by support from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and can be found online with stories from across the country at frequencynews.ca.
Hallelujah-Halu is a local musician. She's been active on the scene for a few years now. Former CJSF volunteer, too. This is a track from one of her latest releases. This is Manic Pixie Pacifist.
Don't call me and expect anything other than my usual apathetic tone. I'm not a cop, I'm not a priest, but you'll confess it all to me. Knows. Maybe I'm just a manic pixie pacifist at the real of the life that you've been living in. Just a step in a character development. Was I just playing a role when you were taking me home? We took the day to cry. I told you I'm afraid to change you.
Pixie Pacifist. Let's take a quick look at the weather here for the week ahead. I think we're going to have basically the whole week's going to be a lot like the weekend was. Next couple of days are a mix of sun and cloud with highs up to 16. By midweek, we're looking at cloudy with a bit of a cooling trend that starts to turn around on Saturday with a switch back to a mix of sun and cloud on Sunday with expectations of rain on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So I guess you need to keep your coat with you and maybe bring an umbrella just in case. And hopefully it's not going to be too bad. Next up, we have a look at the birds. This is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. With white and gray feathers, a piercing stare, and noisy screams, the American herring gull is what most folks might call a seagull. But you're likely to see these gulls far from shore, too. The American herring gull is one of four nearly identical species found in temperate regions of the Northern Hemisphere, including the European herring gull, Vega gull, and Mongolian gull. In fact, ornithologists once lumped them all together under the single species name herring gull until 2024, when scientists found key differences in their genetics, appearance, and vocalizations. Just as raucous and hefty as its cousins, you can find American herring gulls from Alaska to Puerto Rico, squabbling over table scraps at an inland landfill, or scarfing down French fries by the beach. It takes juvenile herring gulls 4 years to grow into their iconic adult plumage. You can tell the youngsters apart from their elders by their speckled gray-brown body feathers. But even young birds can compete with the adults in size and volume. American herring gulls are about 2 feet long from beak to tail, with a nearly 6-foot wingspan that's perfect for soaring across land and sea. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is sponsored by Laura Potash of Roslyn, Washington.
All right. Thank you to Bird Note for that.
Because we do have a trade war with the United States here. Now, would they call it the American seagull? Is this what's at Lougheed Mall? Which is interesting because they're actually, for one time, I can say I've seen these birds. But he said speckled. Isn't a seagull kind of like a uniform color of that dull blue and white? A seagull?
Or gray?
Yeah, I mean, what if it was this?
Well, I guess there are a few different kinds of gulls.
The thing was, he said, is this what they have in the United States, a speckled gull? But, you know, when you have a like an animated cartoon, for example, when they've shown a seagull, it's like what I see at Lougheed Mall. Mm-hmm. So that's the stereotypical seagull. Now, what's interesting is that's a bit away from the sea, Lougheed Mall.
It is.
Which is the area that I live in. So I presume it's the garbage they're getting.
Probably.
But, yeah, I mean, because it's interesting how far inland they come. Anyway, so I just thought to do a bit of a localization for this American little United States little thing. We got to be careful with these people.
Well, they have lots of Canadian stuff, and they've even had over the years a number of local stuff.
But what's this speckled gull? I've never seen this speckled gull in my life.
I don't know. Okay. Well, I'll look it up in the internet. Maybe I'll get back to it. All right, Gardening with Embark will be up in just a few minutes. But before then, we have this report from our friends at CJLO Radio in Montreal about the importance of container gardening on patios to pollinators.
You're listening to CJLO News.
We got two gardening shows.
A Concordia-based research group is encouraging people to start balcony gardens this summer, saying even individual gardening in a small space can create biodiversity hotspots.
My research focus is on looking at how we can design urban green spaces, smaller ones, to be supporting biodiversity in the city.
That was Nicole Yu, a PhD candidate from Concordia's Department of Biology, researching with the ZEDER Urban Landscape Ecology Lab.
With this project, I'm working with balconies to see how individual efforts to green the city can also contribute to helping out our fellow non-human neighbors in the city.
You is looking for participants in neighborhoods across Montreal to garden on their balconies so she can study the positive effects this may have on pollination.
Looking for people with balconies who are not on the ground floor, and also they're not too close to the water. What we'll do is we'll give them plants in grow bags that we know are beneficial for pollinators. They provide good nectar for them. And for the summer, the participants will just have those plants on their balcony, and using time-lapse cameras that we provide, survey what pollinators come to visit those flowers.
Montreal has over 300 different pollinating species that vary across the island. Yu says in some neighborhoods where large gardening or biodiversity infrastructure projects can't fit, the solution could lie in individual residents growing on their balconies.
We can actually see if we want to be doing some small-scale greening efforts, even at an individual level, what can the impact potentially be, and how can urban planners try to promote small-scale urban planning, small-scale greening too, to improve biodiversity where we may not have as much funding or the space to be doing like an entire large park or conserving a natural area.
Yu is almost done gathering participants, but she says this research should encourage any citizens to begin balcony gardens, suggesting it could improve healthy ecosystems in our urban environments. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
Ducks Unlimited Canada works with landowners and other conservation-minded partners to improve outcomes for communities.
It's time for Gardening with Embark. Joining me in the studio here is Pablo Vimas, gardening expert for Embark Sustainability. And Embark and Pablo runs the Learning Gardens program here at SFU.
Good morning.
And we're into week 19.
Correct.
We got lots of bright sunshine happening outdoors and shining in on our gardens.
Yes.
And things are growing quickly.
Yes, fantastically quickly. It has warmed up very quick, and the vegetables that like cold weather are bolting, which means they're going into flower.
Right.
So that is one thing that tells us that summer is approaching. And the other is some of the cold crops, like broccoli and cabbages, start being affected by pests, mainly aphids at the moment. So aphids are in the garden together with white flies. Yep. And yeah, the typical slugs around munching on our vigilance.
And keeping on top of those and keeping under control is pretty important.
Yeah. Basically is that we are growing vegetables either for the leaves, for the roots, and we don't want to lose that.
Right.
We don't want to share with the, with the insects. Now and then they show up in the garden, and yeah, we have to learn how to manage them. Pest management. So what basically we do is observe until how the population is small of the insects. For instance, the aphids. If you see aphids, we will just squish them and try to reduce the population.
So you mentioned them quickly, but what are the key pests we're worried about, and what do they look like?
Okay, so we have the aphids, which are tiny little green insects that live underneath the leaves.
Yeah.
And they have a mouth system that sucks the sap from the leaves, and that's what we don't want.
Right.
And the leaf that is affected by those aphids tends to curl and deform.
Yeah.
So that's one of the signs that we see when we're looking into the garden. That's one. And the other is the caterpillars. Either particularly the cabbage, the white cabbage butterfly. At the moment, there are white butterflies going around, laying their eggs. The eggs hatch, and we have these nice green caterpillars.
Right.
And that way, then we have the roly-polies. They usually like to eat the base of the leaves or the cabbage.
Is that the little, like a pill bug?
The pill bug, yeah.
And so sort of rolls up into a little ball.
Little ball, yeah. That's what you call. So they love to eat the stem below, close to the soil.
Yeah.
Then we have the typical slugs that they munch on the leaves. And the only thing that we see is this trail, a silver trail that they leave. Now and then we can find some snails. But yeah. I like the snails, so I just pick them and move it around.
Yeah.
But yeah, slugs, I think they're hungrier than the snails.
Right.
So once you identified the insect that is eating your vegetables. The next is to identify how many are there, so mm-hmm. how the aphids are spread. It's just in one plant or it's on several plants, is just in one tiny spot or it's all along the plant. And then based on that, based on the amount of aphids or the insects present, then it comes how to control them.
Right.
So as I was saying, if it's a small amount of aphids, we just with a squish until you continue. If the population explodes, well, there is other options like using soapy water to wash the leaves. Mm-hmm. And if the you see from the from the top to the bottom covered on aphids, there is no point to fight them. Right. They have won the battle. The only thing is for us to remove the plant. Yeah. Don't put in the compost. We put something up aside to taking away from the garden.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what we do with aphids. And as well, aphids and ants, mm-hmm. they go together.
Yeah.
So ants...
Because the ants come for the aphids.
Aphids secrete a liquid called honeydew, and ants love that. That sweet okay. stuff. So ants kind of farm the aphids.
Right.
And so the ants are up and down collecting all the honeydew. And at the moment, I haven't seen many ladybugs, which are the predators of the aphids.
Yeah.
And ants kind of protect the aphids from the ladybugs.
Right.
So it's kind of a, I farm you, I protect you. So
right.
So, and then we have ants. Yeah. Now and then, at the beginning, we had one of our gardens with an ant nest in there.
Yeah.
And yeah, how we control that. So the only thing that we did was to change the soil from the box.
Right.
Because we tried to do borax and sugar 50-50 spread, did not work.
Yeah.
And so the only thing, we just completely destroyed the nest and put fresh soil in the box.
Right. Which and again, not moving that soil to the compost or anywhere.
No, that's all we just scattered there. In the nearby forest, we scattered that.
Yeah.
But so that slugs, they like to show up around early in the morning mm-hmm. or early in the evening. So yeah. around 5-6 o'clock, they like to show up. And then the one, the time that you can go and pick them up
yeah.
and collect them. And what I usually do is just snip in halves and leave the body there for the microorganisms living in the soil to right. benefit. Sometimes we can pick it up and put in the composter, but they make their way back.
Right.
One thing that we always do is to keep everything clean, all the pots clean yeah. around our garden bed. So yeah. no debris, no pots, nowhere they can hide.
Yeah.
And so because they like to hide in a humid, dark space, sometimes we as well place pieces of wood, and that's a trap. So mm-hmm. now and then we come lift the piece of wood and there are all the slugs there hiding, yeah. collect them and dispose it.
Right. Yeah.
We try to avoid using salt. I think many people say spray salt on top of the slugs. I think that's a cruel mm-hmm. thing to get yeah. rid of. What I do is just a snap, quick, done.
Yeah. Yeah.
But rather than seeing the little creature twist and with salt, yeah. So that with caterpillars, that you have to develop good eyes
mm-hmm.
because they blend. They are green little things that blend very nice with the leaves.
Right.
Either in the main stem and the front or the back of the leaf, they are just, you can look back, up back, and you don't notice them. And suddenly, they are hiding.
Right. Yeah. Do they eat the leaves? Can you see where
they have been munching it. You can see. And usually they go through it. There's this nice little hole. They don't go through the edge. They just munch through the leaves.
So when you see that, you know you got to start taking a really close look at that plant.
Yes.
For those guys mm-hmm. hiding in plain sight, so to speak.
Yes, yes. They hide very nicely. They camouflage. So that's why every time we are gardening or sharing with our students is visit the garden
mm-hmm.
As often as you can, at least once a week. But if you come 2-3 times, you start creating that relationship and you start tracking what's happening in the garden, yeah. what insects are showing up, what are the good ones, what are the bad ones. With the ladybugs, it's interesting because they have different stages. They go from egg to a pupa to a young and then an adult,
mm-hmm.
and all of them have different shapes.
Right.
And so when I was learning as well about the ladybug, I was unfortunately killing the good ones
right.
because they were like in the young age, like the little crocodiles, nice little insects. So that is, I think, everyone who does gardening is learning by doing the mistakes.
Yeah.
Later realized like, I will learn that was the caterpillar at a young stage. So like, mm-hmm. I shouldn't damage it. I should protect it. So now they make every time that we see about our ladybug, we just hold it and change place. Protect them as well.
Great. Are there other pests we need to worry about?
other pests.
Like you mentioned about liking the snails. I mean, are snails a problem?
Yes, they eat the leaves, similar like the slugs.
Yeah.
But somehow they are more attractive because they have the shells.
Yeah, they are definitely cuter.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I think in our gardens there are very few. I have noticed 3 or 4, so the population is very low, which I'm okay living with it. The other thing is that, for instance, let's talk about the slugs or snails. They will eat the leaf. Mm-hmm. If you have a full leaf, that means that there is no pest.
Yeah.
But later you see half of the leaf being munched. I'll say, okay, now I have to take action because my plant still can produce food using half of the leaf.
Yeah.
And still can grow and produce. But less than that, it's like, the leaf is useless because it's not producing enough nutrients for the plant.
Right.
Yeah, so that's one of the thing that I would like to... We need to consider how much of the leaf has been eaten in order to take action with the slugs. Right. But as I say, snails, one or two... Yeah, they're welcome in the garden.
Are there preventative steps you can take to sort of try and minimize pest impact? Because I know sometimes, I don't know about in the garden, but I know with potted plants, sometimes if you overwater them, you'll all of a sudden get aphids, for example, I think.
What happens is that plants are sick.
Yeah.
And a sick plant emits the energy, the color that the insect sees in it, to the plant, and that sends a signal I'm sick. Mm-hmm. It's nature.
Yeah.
You see this a sick and weak individual, the nature takes to control them.
Yeah.
The healthy ones are okay. So that's the reason. So if you water too much, kind of your poor little plant is being drowned and weakening his immune system, so therefore brings that image to the insects. I'm sick, come here, it's food.
Right.
So preventing, not too much watering. And preventing the, ensuring that the soil that is rich in nutrients before you plant your seeds. Mm-hmm. Feeding the plant, particularly tomatoes, when it's time to feeding them once a month with some fertilizer, some compost. At the moment, that will be how to make the plant healthy.
Yeah.
By making our plant healthy as well, we need to ensure that the soil is healthy. So as a healthy soil, a healthy plant, less pests.
All right. So we're in week 19, still middle of the spring, but we need to be doing this watching and clean up throughout the season, yeah?
Yeah, completely. We are starting right now because the weather has improved so nicely.
Yeah.
So we will go all the way until September.
Yeah.
Since from now on, is keep an eye on your garden and the pests and keep the garden tidy. And one thing that many advice is that spray the leaves, if you see aphids, spray the leaves with a jet. I found that it damaged the leaves.
Right.
Too strong the jet of water damaged the leaves.
Yeah.
And remember, the leaves is the food factory of a plant. So through chlorophyll, nutrients, and the sunlight create sugars, basically. And without a healthy working leaf, there is no creation of sugar. Therefore, the plant is struggling to make their own food.
Great. Well, so just like watering, keeping a good close eye on our plants is something we're going to be doing from now until the end of the season.
That's right.
And one of the keys to having a really successful growing season.
That's right. And if you, by visiting the garden quite often, you will start seeing what is new. And take the time to learn which insect is that and how it can be controlled as well.
Excellent. Great advice, Pablo. Thank you so much. Pablo Vimas, gardening's manager for Embark Sustainability, who run the learning gardens up here on the campus at SFU and a number of programs as well that students can participate in. How do people find out more about Embark?
Embark has our website, embarksustainability.org, or you can follow us in our social media channels at #EmbarkSustainability.
Great. Thanks so much for joining me today, Pablo.
Thank you.
Pablo Vimas of Embark. See you next week.
See you. Bye-bye.
Ducks Unlimited Canada works with landowners and other conservation-minded partners to improve outcomes for communities and wildlife. Supporting vital ecosystems which contribute to water quality and quantity, soil health, support agriculture and economy, mitigate severe weather events, and provide opportunities for recreational access to nature. Together, we are unlimited. Learn more about programs and partnerships at ducks.ca.
Well, so be it. You choose the path of a psychopath. Well, I wasn't born to love at all costs. In fact, I could only love a cause that's been already lost, and I wasn't put on this earth to argue with you. Didn't want to look up, but I did. The sky hid. Who knows what's out there, really? X marks the spot, the whole thing's an X. The sun mostly rises, a great golden spike through the heart of the world. Bluebirds in flight twirl towards the words I think of you in a little out of the way cafe. Coming undone, you get what you get, and you don't get inside your leather jacket and walk away in the direction.
Vancouver's Destroyer and Ignoramus of Love from a new album from Destroyer. Destroyer is, of course, Vancouver's Dan Behar, and sometimes a bunch of other folks, sometimes mostly just him. And that album was called Dan's Boogie, or is called Dan's Boogie. And yeah. All right, Peter. We're heading into the last bit of our program for today. And Peter's got some stuff to talk about, but well, before we get there, yeah. I'm teasing you. I keep cutting. Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, so Thursday in this building, we operate out of the Student Union building at SFU.
Yeah.
I saw the poster of it. From 2 to 4 p.m. Thursday, there's going to be it's protesting throwing out food here at Simon Fraser, a part of the it's involved with the dining hall. As a non-student, I've been there a few times.
I think, well, it probably does have to do with the dining hall. I think it also has to do with conference services, where, you know, they'll take food out to an event, you know, appetizers and all that stuff, and it's there for a couple hours or so, and some of it gets eaten, and then everything that doesn't get eaten just gets tossed in the garbage. And I'm, you know, so that's one thing. And then I have no idea what kind of food waste there is that generated through the various food services places on campus that are run by the SFU itself. And I imagine that's something they'll talk a bunch about at this protest. But it's also tied into the fact that SFU, due to budget cuts, is at the very same time they're throwing out all this food, is closing down, well, wanted to close down the food pantry, which is kind of a food bank for students up here on campus. And that's not going to happen, mostly because the Student Society is taking over operation and management of it, which is interesting in itself because the food pantry was originally started by the students, and the Student Society. And eventually the university said, hey, we think this is a great idea. We're going to run it, which they often do. And then now they're getting out of that business, and and in order to keep it going, the Student Society is going to take over the food pantry, and so these issues are tied together. You know, on the one hand, you know, a service for students is under threat, a food security service for students is under threat at the same time the university is throwing out large amounts of food.
So that's going to be on the fifth floor of this building, Thursday. It's just a student union building here.
Yeah.
So anyway, I might, or somebody else might, do a report on it too, or bring.
Yep.
We'll see what happens.
Yep.
Anyway, so what I'm going to bring up is that ever since Rebel News is like an Uncle Tom Canuck about things, they seem to take the side of Trump. Mm-hmm. Even though they're Canadian. So I've been sort of annoyed by them, but I'm sort of on my tablet when I go to libraries on the YouTube. They usually pop up. But there have been – I'm going to say something really negative about Rebel News. I'm going to bring up a few things I kind of liked about it. One thing is that Ezra Levant went to
Ezra Levant is like the editor or something,
yeah,
right?
Well, yeah. No, he's the head – host.
Publisher? Okay, yeah.
Well, it's all YouTube postings, you know.
Right.
So he went to Bermuda to check up on Bellmark. I think it's the one of the corporations Mark Carney was involved with.
Right.
And they also went earlier to the Isle of Man, but I didn't see. And he was wearing his Bermuda shorts going there as a joke, you know. But he didn't want to pay for the hotel, so they went there and back. But it was sort of interesting that they checked up on it. It was sort of interesting to go, and it was up above a bike shop. They did have sort of an office, and then they did phone the New York office and said, well, how much is this to avoid taxation or something? So that was an interesting report they had done, even though they're kind of ticking me off, you know, Rebel News. And there was actually one other thing, is that there's a woman. Actually, I met her a few times because I know I was with the COVID protesting and so on. But she said something in Kitimat, some of the workers weren't able to vote. Mm-hmm. And that was a good report. I didn't hear it anywhere else. And she was documented that they were.
Do you mean in just the recent election?
Yes. So that was a good one. The other thing that they brought up is that the People's Party of Canada, they had a candidate on commercial driving. Now, this was a bit of an odd thing. It was that she is now in Mexico, but
your friend.
What?
Your friend? Candidate?
My friend. I don't.
Oh, the candidate is in Mexico.
Yes, the candidate for the PPC.
Right.
She's not my friend.
Okay. I'm getting confused. Anyway,
the other woman isn't my friend either. I did, okay. But what she did, I've seen her a few times.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, it's all. But she's a Vancouver correspondent. For the commercial drive area, the PPC candidate who lives in Mexico, but I guess he was going to come up for the campaign, but her bank account got frozen. Which is what they were doing. Well, was to people. I gave $5 to the trucker convoy. I can't eat for 2 months.
Right.
You know, it seemed to be that, and that wasn't mentioned. You know, otherwise. So, but no. Anyway, now I got time. Okay, yeah. Rebel News. Ezra Levant interviewed Ann Coulter, which is not good.
Yeah.
And the thing was, I was a bit kind of shocked by that because. you know, Ann Coulter had really discredited herself strongly by saying this person who was born in the United States, who was of East Indian ascent, or descent, and said, oh, I wouldn't vote for you because you're not third or fourth generation in this mm-hmm. country. And Ann Coulter isn't on The View anymore. She's not on Glenn Beck anymore. But I said, what was the point of that? Was a real mistake, I think, of him. I did confront him about Conrad Black because they were doing these. He was interviewing him on the air and all this, and he said, "Oh well, he weren't the first one to criticize me about that." He kind of just like a duck with all the water going on the back. But that's not. But the other thing is that even though you may disagree, kind of with sort of a news outlet, sometimes it's still good to still look at it, but they might do things that you're interested in. So that's,
well, it is good to sort of see what different front people on different fronts are saying. You know, you could say the biggest problem. Well, we're out of time now, so we got to leave it there.
Anyway,
Democracy Now! Is up in just a few seconds. You've been listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll be back next week, and Democracy Now! Is right up now.